Okay, well, feels like the middle of the week before spring break, doesn't it? I didn't want to do anything heavy today. I thought on Friday I'd save something that's kind of fun, but not wouldn't have anything terribly new, just a great application of what we've been thinking about. I want to solve the vibrating square drum problem on Friday. It mostly involves stuff we know, but it leads to some pretty interesting conclusions. And it'll be a good way to sort of recap things we've done. But today, so that's Friday. And I think I'll record it better than usual, so if you have to miss Friday, then you can catch up at your leisure. I thought today I would review the exam, and I promised I would show you an easy thing about solving the Dirichlet problem on a disk, namely that if the data is rational, then the solution is rational. So I hope I'll have time to get to that. It's very straightforward and elementary and kind of surprising. So let's see the exam. I wanted to show you solutions, or at least summarize solutions. One was, I'd like to get the exams graded by Friday, but if I don't, I'll grade them early in spring break and have those scores on Blackboard for you. I have another class with a whole bunch of exams to grade too, so I'm not sure I'll make it. So number one, I gave you these functions, which x to the seventh, cosine 3x, and 1. And the problem was to show that they're orthogonal. That means pairwise orthogonal on the interval minus pi to pi. That means you take any two of them. They need to integrate to 0 from minus pi to pi. So, for example, these are real valued things, so I don't have to do the conjugate business. But the hardest one would be to think about cosine 7th, x to the 7th cosine 3x dx. If you're going to integrate that the freshman calculus way, you would integrate by parts 7 times. Or maybe use a reduction formula that's equivalent to integrating by parts 7 times. That would be no fun. And it would be a big waste of time because this function, x to the 7th, is odd. Cosine 3x is even. And therefore, an odd times an even is an odd. And we're integrating over a symmetric interval, so that is a big fat 0. So that sort of required you to know odd and even function facts to calculate that. So that's one pair. Another pair was x to the 7th times 1, which is the same business work there, although that's an easy one to calculate. So minus pi to pi, x to the 7th times 1 dx. This is odd, and so that's equal to 0. So that only leaves one more pair to calculate, and this pair is one we know from Fourier series. Integral from minus pi to pi of 1 times cosine 3x. This is an even function. So the only thing knowing that it's an even function gives us is that this would be, let's see, it would be 2 times the integral from 0 to pi of cosine 3x. And you can just calculate, either you can say we know that 1 and cosine 3x are orthogonal because those are the Fourier series functions. And the interval is minus pi to pi. And we know that cosine nx, sine nx, and 1 are the orthogonal basis for Fourier series. So you could either quote that or just calculate it. This would be 1/3 sine 3x evaluated between 0 and pi, 2 times that, and that's 0 because cosine 3 pi is 0. So that's the three things to check to make sure they're orthogonal. And then I gave you kind of a mini theory of Fourier series problem. If we had f expanded in terms of these functions, of course, not many functions can be expanded in terms of these three. In fact, they're all functions of this form. So it's not like Fourier series where you can get any function because you need an infinite sum to be able to get any old function out of these. But if f happens to be expandable, then I wanted you to write down the coefficient c1 like you would if it was a Fourier series. So the key is to use orthogonality. If I want to isolate c1, I would multiply this thing by x to the 7th. And then integrate. And so I'd get an integrate from minus pi to pi, x to the 7th f of x dx. The integral of x to the 7th with the one the c0 times 1 term would integrate to 0. The integral of x to the 7th times cosine 3x would integrate to 0 because they're orthogonal. But then I get 1 that doesn't integrate to 0. And that would give me c1 times the integral from minus pi to pi of x to the 7th squared, something that's strictly positive, so there's no way that's going to be 0. And let's see, that would be x to the 14th, so this would be c1 times 1/15 x to the 15th, evaluated between minus pi and pi. That would be equal. So what I'd get in the end is that c1 would be the integral from minus pi to pi of x to the 7th f of x dx. And when I calculate that number, let's see, I think I could get 2/15. Because I get thing minus a minus. 2/15 pi to the 15th. Questions about problem one? That was supposed to be just, I haven't graded it yet, so I'm hoping it went smoothly. I kind of gave a hint about it last week. Number two is one I think I might have kind of almost done in class once. It's a Sturm-Liouville problem, and I only wanted you to calculate these special functions when lambda is positive. So you didn't have to go mess around with all the cases. Turns out there's no non-zero solutions in the other cases, only in the lambda equal positive case. So I just wanted you to skip those because they're a waste of time. And we're on the integral from 0 to pi. And we have boundary values. X prime of 0 equals 0. And x at the other endpoint is equal to 0. So this corresponds to a heat problem where I've got an insulated end at 0 and a refrigerated holding at 0 degrees end at pi. So it's a hot wire problem. Left end is insulated and the right end is held to 0 degrees. That's where this problem comes from. And so if lambda is positive, case, that means I can write lambda equals k squared to make it positive. And then my characteristic equation would be r squared plus k squared equals 0, and that has solutions r equals plus or minus ki. And so the general solution to the differential equation would be x of x equals c1 cosine kx plus c2 sine kx. Okay, so that's the general solution, and now we have to mess around and try to make those boundary conditions hold. And that's going to pin down some lambdas. Most lambdas aren't going to work. And so let's see if I need I'm going to need x prime, so I better calculate. X prime of x would equal minus c1k sine kx plus c2k cosine kx. And I need x prime of 0. Let's see, when I plug that in, sine of 0 is 0. So that is a big fat 0. And c2k cosine of 0 is 1. And I need this equal to 0. And so that tells me that the c2 has got to be 0. And that means this whole piece of the solution is just not there. And the other thing I need is x at pi to be 0. And now when I write in x of pi, it's simpler now because I can chuck that other piece of the solution. X of pi is up here. X of pi would be c1 cosine k pi. And I want that to equal to 0. And that's the key to making lambda, key to finding a lambda. If this cosine k pi is not 0, then I would have to have c1 equal to 0. So I don't want c1 equal to 0, because then I'd get the 0 solution. So this is what I need to be 0 in order to get a non-zero solution. And if you think of what values of k that pins down, cosine, I'd graph cosine here. Cosine has the top of a hump. There it's 0. There it's 0. There it's 0. So let's see, this is pi over 2. This is 3 pi over 2. This is cosine theta. This would be 5 pi over 2. Etc. These are odd multiples of pi over 2. So we see this. So the spots we need are these zeros. So we need k pi needs to be a zero of cosine. So k pi needs to be an odd multiple of pi over 2. Or you could write that as n plus a half pi, as n goes from 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. However you like. So those are the values of lambda that give me non-zero solutions. Let's see, lambda equals k squared. And so that would be n plus a half pi. Oh, let's see. Yeah, pi squared. Oh, so the pi's cancel, sorry. That's what k pi is equal to. So k is equal to just n plus a pi half squared, as n goes from 0, 1, 2, 3. Those are all possible positive values where I get non-zero solutions, and the corresponding functions I would get an xn of x equals cosine n plus a half pi. I'm times x, rather. That's the k. Any questions about that one? These are not standard Fourier series functions.
The Fourier series functions are cosine nx. This is n plus a half x, and there's no sine terms, there's no constant term. It's a fascinating fact that I can expand functions in terms of these things. Question?
Yeah, what about the prefactor?
The what?
C1 or something.
The C1. I'm looking, these are called eigenfunctions. And the eigenspace would be all multiples of this. Except, of course, it's the 0 one. You wouldn't want 0 times your eigenvector. So these are like eigen... the reason they're called eigenfunctions... So these are called eigenfunctions. And it's kind of like linear algebra. That's why I don't put a constant there. Because you know your eigenfunctions can be scaled. Your eigenvectors. These are called eigenfunctions. There's going to be eigenfunctions in the vibrating square drumhead problem that are pretty interesting. And the reason they're called eigenfunctions is if I write the differential equation like this, think of this as a linear transformation. When you're dealing with matrices, the matrix multiplication is a linear transformation. And so, an eigenfunction is matrix times vector is just a stretch of the vector. And this is like the same thing, except the operator here is the twice derivative operator. And so you take two derivatives, and it's the same as stretching your function by a factor. That's why they're called eigenfunctions. The eigenfunctions for this operator, and this is kind of like the Laplacian. It's the one-dimensional Laplacian. So later on, we'll think about eigenfunctions for the Laplace operator. Laplacian u equals lambda times u. They're fascinating, and they come up in lots of different places.
Eigenfunctions for d by dx squared. Questions about that one?
Yeah, and so a fascinating fact is that these are orthogonal. They form a complete orthogonal set, and so there's like a Parseval's identity, and any function can be expanded in terms of them.
So that's a consequence of Sturm-Liouville theory. So they're orthogonal. And they're complete, meaning you've got a Parseval's identity. So Bessel's becomes a Parseval's.
So is the full statement just like if you have a Sturm-Liouville problem, you get that?
Yeah, there's a general theorem about Sturm-Liouville problems that you get generalized Fourier series, and they're complete, and they and you can expand just like Fourier series. It's a very beautiful old subject. And you'll find it in books, especially engineering books use this a lot, because every time you have a new kind of problem, the Fourier series is pretty special, and every time you have a new kind of problem with different kinds of boundary conditions, you get a new kind of Fourier series. So it's a one theory fits all. The thing about Fourier series is that they were studied so intensely, and a lot of math was invented just to study Fourier series. So still they're worth spending a whole semester course on. Number three, I hope was easy for you. The trick when we did the geometric series, when you multiply the geometric series by 1 minus z, you get a lot of cancellations. So you write it out like this, 1 plus z plus blah, 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 that's 1 times it. And then I'm going to multiply it by minus z. That would move it over here. Z plus z squared plus blah, blah, blah. Z to the n would be there. But then I'd get 1 hanging out over the right here. That's z times that series. And then when I subtract, I'm left, everything cancels in the middle except the last term. And I get 1 minus z to the n plus 1.
And so the famous formula for that geometric series is 1 minus z to the n plus 1 over 1 minus z.
Of course, that works as long as z is not equal to 1. If z is equal to 1, this is kind of dumb. 1 plus 1 plus 1, it would be equal to n. The reason I gave you this problem was just because I know you thought about summing the thing to get the Dirichlet series, the Dirichlet kernel, and then summing the Dirichlet kernel to get the Fayer kernel. And it always involved tricks where you use this formula in conjunction with the fact that cosine theta is the real part of e to the I theta. And e to the I, let's see, cosine n theta is equal to the real part of e to the I n theta. And so you realize, aha, the sum of these cosine terms is the real part of a geometric series.
So 1 plus cosine theta plus blah, 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 out to cosine n theta. That would be equal to the real part of 1 plus e to the I theta plus e to the I 2 theta plus et cetera. And that's a geometric series. See, so that'd be the real part of 1 plus e to the I theta plus e to the I theta squared. And last one would be e to the I theta to the n. And therefore, the closed formula for this would be the real part of 1 minus e to the I n plus 1 theta over 1 minus e to the I theta.
You could call yourself done at this moment if you wanted to. If you had time to kill, it'd be fun to play around and get a nice, to clean this up in terms of real functions. This is a real function, but I could play around and find real and imaginary parts and spit out a nice clean formula involving cosines and sines for the sum.
Just like we did for the Dirichlet series, Dirichlet kernel. Oh, good, I told you don't have to simplify the expression, so you could quit right there. Questions about that one? Well, I realized I couldn't make my exam too technical, but I still wanted to make it interesting. And I think this problem number 4 is a great kind of interesting thing that happens when you start thinking about harmonic functions and the averaging property. So I asked you to think about a function that has an isolated zero at the center. So that's z naught. Z naught is an isolated zero of a real value. So if there if something is an isolated zero, it means I can shrink down a disk, get a disk of radius rho, so that this is the only zero inside that disk. So it's an isolated zero of u, which is a real valued function, and I can shrink rho so it's the only zero. That's what it means to be isolated. And I'll make that on the closed unit. I might as well make it continuous up to the boundary. Why not? I guess I don't need the closure.
And now I wanted you to show that when I shrink down like this, that my function has to be either always positive in this region or always negative.
Anybody figure that out? Or how did you figure it out? Yeah, it's exactly. Uh-oh. Never mind about that.
So let's say it was positive right here.
Let's say here's a spot where it's positive, and let's say here's a spot where it's negative.
That would mean it would have to go from being positive to negative. And so you would expect, aha, there must be a place in between where the thing would have zero.
And in fact, this is a two-dimensional problem. How could I make it a one-dimensional problem? That's the intermediate value theorem. If it goes from minus to plus, it has to go through zero somehow. How would I make it a one-dimensional problem?
Did you find a path?
Yeah. In fact, there's lots of paths that connect those two. Here's a nice one. Just take the straight line. Oh, I don't want to go through Z. No. So I don't know. You don't have to be too fancy about this. I could take I could go around on a circle and then go out on a radial direction or something.
That would define me a unique path.
Or, let's see, what else could I do? I could just go zoom like this.
That's a good path to pick. And if I actually run into Z naught, I would go around it. I'd make a little D-shaped detour around it. Then I would get a curve that avoids Z naught. And then I'd have, when I parameterize that curve in terms of a parameter, then I'd have a one-dimensional function.
So I would have this curve gamma here. I can make gamma miss Z naught. And I can parametrize it by Z of t, or X of t of Y of t. I guess I'm thinking of my complex variables class. X of t, Y of t, as t goes from 0 to 1. And then I look at u of x of t and y of t is continuous. And it's negative at the zero endpoint. Let's call this h of t. H of 0 is less than 0. H of 1 is bigger than 0. And so intermediate value theorem would give me a spot in the middle where it's equal to 0. Intermediate value theorem gives a t-naught with 0 less than t naught less than 1, where h of t naught equals 0. And if you think about that in this picture, that would give me a spot somewhere between these two where there's a 0.
And that is not allowed. Z naught is the only zero. So there can't be a zero on that curve. In fact, funny thing is, I could do this with every curve, and I'd get a zero on every one of them. So there'd be a whole bunch of zeros all over the place if this were possible. In fact, that's another way to see they can't be isolated. Is it? But no, I haven't shown this. I haven't assumed anything about the thing being harmonic.
So that's a contradiction. There are no zeros. So that shows that it's either always positive or always negative. And now the key is to realize that if you use the averaging property, so we've got this spot Z naught, and let's suppose it's always positive. In here. So that would be the disk of radius rho about z naught minus the center. Then when I did the averaging property, remember z naught's a zero, so I would have zero is u of z naught, and that would be 1 over 2 pi, the integral from 0 to 2 pi, of u of z naught plus r e to the i t dt.
And it's always positive on this black circle. And so this would be strictly positive.
If it's continuous and always positive, this integral would be strictly positive.
And that's a contradiction. Zero can't be something that's strictly positive. And so that means that this picture just can't happen. I can't have an isolated zero of a harmonic function. By the way, I assumed it was always positive. I could do the case always negative and then I would take minus the thing and get it always positive. So I only have to do it for one of the cases, because just take minus it to get the other case.
So I could say it's always positive on, if it's not, I would take minus u in place of u.
Oh yes, yeah, and the harmonic functions satisfy the averaging property. So this shows that harmonic functions can't have isolated zeros. The zeros actually have to be curves. And the funny thing is, if the curves cross, they have to cross at very specific angles. But that's a fancier thing to check. They have to cross at angles 2 pi divided by an integer. So that's the exam. Any questions about the exam?
Okay, I just wanted to finish up that loose end about rational solutions to the Dirichlet problem. So rational solutions to the Dirichlet problem. With rational data. On the unit disk.
Turns out this is a snap. And the key to this thing is a thing called the Schwarz function.
For the unit disk. Which actually, I'd say maybe it's for the unit circle. And the Schwarz function is S of z equals 1 over z.
That's a nice function. And what's nice about it
is it's equal to z bar on the circle.
Because on the circle, z would be e to the I theta, and 1 over e to the I theta is e to the minus I theta, and e to the minus I theta is z bar. Or you could, if it has modulus 1, what else could you do? You could go like this.
1 over z equals 1 over z times z bar over z bar. And that would be z bar over z bar is mod z squared. And that would be z bar on C1, 0.
So a Schwarz function is a nice analytic function like this, 1 over z, that's equal to the conjugate of an analytic function, z bar, on the boundary.
Whenever you got a region that has one of those things, it's nice. Okay, so let me give you some data for the Dirichlet problem. Data phi. And let's make it be rational. It's going to be rational in X and Y. Then we saw this trick of turning it into a function of z and z bar. Remember, x is z plus z bar over 2, and y is z minus z bar over 2i. If I multiply that all and collect terms, now I get a rational function. I'll call it q. In z and z bar. And now I'm looking for a harmonic function that's equal to this thing on the unit circle. So this is its values on the unit circle. And I want to find a harmonic function that's equal to this on the unit circle. And here's the key. So I'm thinking about on C1, the circle, this thing is equal to Q Z 1 over Z. That's rational in Z. But it might have spots in the inside where it blows up. So this is going to be rational in Z. And you think, oh, that must solve the Dirichlet problem. But it might have spots like 1 over Z where it blows up inside the unit disk. That would be a bummer. But now I'm going to think about this. This would have a partial fractions decomposition. Which, let's see, a partial fractions decomposition would look like a sum of terms. A n k z minus a n to the k. That's what a partial fractions decomposition looks like. These would be finite, so let's see. I'd be summing over the roots, and then I'd be summing as k goes from 1 to m sub n. That's how you do partial fractions in the complex case. Well, some of these zeros are inside the disk, and some are the outside the disk. So I'm going to split this sum into the sum. This would be a sum over the an inside the disk plus a sum of the an outside. If the an is outside, these things are nice. They're analytic functions of z. There's no blowing up, there's no badness. So these things are analytic in z on the unit disk. They don't do anything bad, no blowing up. In fact, even in a bigger set than d10, because there's no bad behavior on the boundary. And now you think about these terms. I can do it, use my Schwarz function. Z on the circle would be equal to 1 over z bar. And so the brilliant idea here is this one I'm going to change. So this would be a sum of a sum. And I'd have things like this, a n k over z minus a n to the k. And the brilliant idea is on the unit circle, I can replace z by 1 over z bar.
And then this does not blow up. This is the conjugate of it. Yes, this takes, this maps the inside of the circle to the outside of the circle. So this has no singularities inside the circle. If you think about how can I make z bar be equal to an, then z would have to be 1 over an bar.
So this blows up. At z equals 1 over a n bar.
And that's outside the unit disk. So in other words, this thing is the conjugate of a nice analytic function of z.
The conjugate of an analytic function.
And now I've got my function written as analytic plus the conjugate of an analytic, and that's exactly what it means to be harmonic.
And that harmonic thing is the solution to the Dirichlet problem. So if you follow all the way down, I have my p of xy equals conjugate of an analytic function plus an analytic function. Where h and h are rational and analytic inside the unit disk. In fact, they're rational and analytic on a bigger set on a disk d rho about 0 with rho bigger than 0, rho bigger than 1.
And that thing solved, therefore that solves the Dirichlet problem. That's a harmonic function and it agrees with
my original data on the C1 part. So this is equal on C1, but this extends and solves to the disk closure and solves the Dirichlet problem. So this is a very constructive way of solving the Dirichlet problem. You give me a rational function, I just do this trick. It's very algorithmic. And I spit out a rational solution to the Dirichlet problem. And so a fascinating thing is you ask yourself, well, can I do that on the ellipse? And the answer is no. So the theorem I mentioned last time is the disk is the only region in the plane that has this problem. The disk. It doesn't have to be the unit disk, but a disk. The disk. I should say a disk. Disks are the only region that have this property. The only domains in the plane. With the rational to rational Dirichlet problem property. With rational data to rational solution.
So I was trying to think of how I could give you the most elementary solution to the Dirichlet problem possible. That on the disk, this is a very constructive way to solve the problem. You give me a rational function, I write out the answer. And so the idea to make a very elementary solution to the Dirichlet problem, if you give me a continuous function, I want to approximate it by rational functions. And then I would use those to to converge to a solution to the Dirichlet problem. And since harmonic functions converge to harmonic functions, it would solve the Dirichlet problem. That's because the averaging property is so easy to check. But I haven't been able to figure out a very elementary way to show you that rational functions are dense. It's true, and I know how to prove it. In fact, you can prove it using Thayer's theorem. But I want a really elementary proof, so you don't have to do anything to solve the Dirichlet problem. And I haven't been able to find it. But I'm still looking. I'm supposed to write a chapter of a book with Steve Krantz. I want to do this in the most elementary way possible, without using the Dirichlet kernel. What did I say? Dirichlet? I meant Poisson kernel. Any questions about that or about anything? Yeah, proving this theorem was probably the most fun I ever had doing math. But I did it with three other people, and it was really fun. Unfortunately, it's the kind of theorem nobody cares about. What are you going to use it for? It's just, okay, you don't even try. There's no other domain that has this property. The disk is very special. But the funny thing is that the ellipse does not have this property. This problem was doable. The question about the ellipse is harder. The Hobson-Shapiro conjecture is a very fascinating conjecture, and it's still wide open. That's maybe the easiest way to solve the Dirichlet problem, that little thing I showed you about polynomials. But it still requires Thayer's theorem. I'd like to find one that doesn't require Thayer's. It's even more elementary. I want to use the Weierstrass theorem about density of polynomials. People think that's more elementary than Thayer's. But they're pretty equivalent. Anyway, that feels like enough for today. So Friday, I'll do the square drum problem and show you, among other things, why it's not very musical. It's going to sound like a clink.